Turns out $54.20 was not a joke. Huh. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, I do believe, the 25th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, just for fun, I am going to see if I can do this in 280 characters, which is, of course, Twitter's limit, starting right now. After making a not very veiled marijuana reference and offering $54.20 a share to buy Twitter, Elon Musk has sealed the deal as of today. Lauren Hirsch has been covering the story for the New York Times. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Setting aside all marijuana jokes that many people made with this price that Musk offered, clearly he was serious, and now this has happened in an unbelievably fast timeline, right?
Unbelievably fast. I'll tell you, I was at a show yesterday, communicating with the source, kind of casually checking in, and my source goes, I think there could be a deal tomorrow. And I go, what?
Yeah.
How is that even possible? I think most people never thought a deal would have happened. And even if people thought there were to be a deal, I don't think anyone thought it could have possibly happened this quickly.
He gets all the money together. They have these board meetings over the weekend and then today. It's a done deal. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, though. And this may be a longer answer than we have time for in the program today. Why does Elon Musk want to buy Twitter?
I can tell you what he has said, which is he would call himself an advocate for free speech, and he doesn't like the way that Twitter has managed content on its platform, and he wants to change that. He spoke in a statement today about kind of decentralizing its content, so effectively allowing users to personalize the content that they see on the app. But I'll tell you, a lot of people really don't know.
Yeah.
You know, that is what he said, but it feels like there might be something deeper here, you know, to spend $40 billion largely of his own money.
Right. I noticed you didn't say he wants to make money. He wants to run it as a better business. And so the logical extension of that is here you have an American oligarch buying a global communications platform.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to have to see what happens.
We're just going to have to see what happens. I don't think we have really ever seen anything like this. You know, obviously, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, but that was very different. He said he would not get involved at all editorially. And Elon Musk has cited editorial concerns as his desire in buying it. So no, we don't really know what the end goal is here. And he said on his TED Talk the day, you know, around the time that he announced his bid, that profit is not a motive. So it'll be interesting to see how this turns out.
It will indeed. To the nuts and bolts of this negotiation, he comes in and says, I want to buy Twitter, and here's my price, final offer. The board says, I don't know. There's talk about a poison pill. The board's clearly not excited. And then presto changeo, the board says yes. Did they just give up and say, you know what? We don't have a better way to run this thing. You do it.
The big presto changeo was him putting together financing. Many people thought he would never be able to do it. But on Thursday, he made public that he had actually culled together, I think, more than the actual offer ended up being. So that changed the game for the board. All of a sudden, they had to take the offer seriously. And the pressure was mounting. Shareholders were calling. And at a certain point, you have to listen to your shareholders, and they seem to be indicating they wanted to go with Elon's deal.
So last thing, and then I'll let you go, because I know you've got reporting to do on this. You're on Twitter. I'm on Twitter. Lots of people we both know are on Twitter, journalists and many others. But the overwhelming majority of the American public isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we care about this?
That's an excellent question. I think it goes to what we were discussing earlier. The power of wealth, certainly in our country, to effectively get pretty much anything you want. I don't think anyone thought that Twitter was in sights, but the fact that he's the richest person in the country makes
it so. In the world, right? Richest guy in the world.
Sorry, I apologize. Yeah. Yes, the richest person in the world makes it so. And all of, you know, as a journalist, you kind of have this very idealistic view of communications and media and how it should be run. And this really has taken the rug out from under that, because this is a man with a clear view And he's going to run it with that Clearview. And I think we all need to rethink the ramifications on communication in the country.
Lauren Hirsch covers business and most recently the Twitter story in Elon Musk for the New York Times. Lauren, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That introduction, by the way, 245 characters. Nailed it. Twitter shares on this Monday up almost 6%. Still, though, a couple of bucks shy of Musk's offer of, once again, $54.20 a piece. Elsewhere, the major indices were up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, mark your calendars for Friday, everybody. That's when the latest inflation numbers are going to be out. We told you about the March Consumer Price Index a couple of weeks ago, up 8.5% year on year, as you surely know by now. This Friday, we get PCE, that's personal consumption expenditures, which the Federal Reserve really likes. But as we all know, everybody is watching inflation right now. There are, though, some nuances in the way that people experience inflation that the official metrics just don't capture.
So I think maybe it could be helpful to like tell a story to sort of emphasize sort of one of the reasons that I decided to study this topic and I thought it was interesting.
I'm sorry, you are?
Yeah, so my name is Jacob Borchard. So I'm a PhD candidate at UC San Diego and actually just finishing up my PhD. And so then after that, I'll be Dr. Orchard. But until then, I'm still a student.
All right, well then, future Dr. Orchard, please go on.
In 2011, Bill Dudley, who was the president of the New York Fed at the time, he was doing an outreach speech to a blue-collar community in New York. And the reason for the speech is people were concerned about cost of living.
Just like they are today. But unlike today,
the actual official measure of inflation wasn't that high.
Back then, some prices, food and energy, of course, were going up a lot. Other prices, not really so much. The CPI, the Consumer Price Index, was up 2.7% year over year when Bill Dudley gave that speech, 8.5% today, as we all know.
And as an example of why the Fed wasn't super concerned about inflation, he gave an example of, you know, if you look at the iPad 2, which had just come out, it's the same price as the iPad 1, and it's better.
Introductory cost of an iPad 1, $499. Introductory cost of an iPad 2 a year later, $499.
You know, some prices are going down. And then someone from the audience shouted, we can't eat an iPad.
Fact check, true.
And I think this just goes to show that, you know, maybe the prices of some things aren't that important for some people. So the actual topic of my dissertation is how the price index for low-income and high-income households can systematically differ over the course of the business cycle.
In other words, where you are on the income spectrum determines your personal inflation rate.
Right now, from March 2022, so this last report that we got, compared to March 2021, the inflation rate for low-income households was running at about 9%. But for high-income households, it's much closer to the average inflation rate at 8.5%.
In other words, inflation is high for everybody, but there is a gap. And if you step back for a second and think big picture, that kind of makes sense.
The two biggest sources of inflation are energy prices and food.
That's Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont.
And for low-income families, they comprise a much larger portion of the budget. So poor families undoubtedly are hit hard.
And there is another piece of this we got to talk about, inflation and jobs. The overall inflation rate is at a 40-year high. The overall unemployment rate, 3.6%, darn near 50-year lows. But there is a huge caveat there. The Latino unemployment rate, 4.2% in March. The Black unemployment rate, 6.2%.
I want to be clear that when you ask people in a survey, do they care more about unemployment or inflation? They say unemployment. They would rather live with some inflation and have a job than have low inflation and no job.
Here's the thing, though. You can raise interest rates to fight inflation, which the Fed does. That slows the economy, and that usually increases unemployment.
We call it the sacrifice ratio. And the sacrifice is disproportionately paid for by people of color. That is, African Americans and Hispanics are disproportionately likely to lose their jobs.
And your job, which you can read as your wages, right? That affects what you buy, which gets reflected in those inflation numbers.
The overall CPI is meant to capture the spending patterns of a typical household, but really nobody's the typical household.
And that gets us to this last point, how we measure inflation in this economy. Daniel Sickle is a professor at Wellesley. Also, though, he's the chair of a National Academy of Sciences committee that is studying ways to modernize the Consumer Price Index. Make it better, right? And more useful. The BLS does publish a couple of versions of the CPI already.
But there's plenty of room for improvement.
Like they could do what Jacob Orchard and other researchers, remember Jacob Orchard, the almost doctor up from the top, could do what they do using data on spending patterns to disaggregate the CPI.
A step further than that would be to develop a data system where they really could link prices of particular items to the demographic characteristics of the people buying them. That would be kind of like the Holy Grail.
Which would be super useful. In the meanwhile, though, waiting for the Holy Grail, later on this week, the Fed's favorite inflation metric, PCE, we will tell you why that is the one that they like. All right, one more quick thing on inflation and wages this time. The National Association for Business Economics is out with a new survey of economists who work at big companies. And those economists, a record number of them, say their businesses have been booking pay increases of late. Yeah, but here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser.
In Lester Jones's world, you need muscle.
We rely on a lot of manual labor.
Jones is chief economist at the National Beer Wholesalers Association.
We move cases of beverages throughout the economy. They're heavy.
Jones says some distributors are competing fiercely for workers, and it's like that all over. 70% of the economists surveyed said wages rose at their companies. That's the highest number in the survey's 40-year history. But for the most part, employers aren't boosting wages enough to keep up with soaring prices. Cornell labor economist Erica Groshen has a theory on that.
They don't want to get too far ahead of inflation because it's hard to dial that back.
Some economists in their survey don't expect their firms to pay workers more in the future, say over the next 3 months. Brad Hirschbein, a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, says that's because employers expect inflation to moderate.
People think that a lot of the supply chain issues will gradually get resolved, and that the war situation in Ukraine may also eventually die down or at least get partially resolved.
But in the meantime, many workers will be stuck with raises that don't keep up with rising prices. And Hirschbein says inflation may not get back to normal levels until next year. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you need to keep that stock up or someone will do it for you.
Well, all righty then. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 238 today, 0.7%, 34,049. The Nasdaq picked up 165 points, about 1.3%, 13,004. The S&P 500 up 24 points, almost 0.6%, finished at 4,296. Trading in Twitter was suspended for a bit just before the purchase of the social media platform was announced. Before that, shares up 5.75%, left shares worth about 5% less than Musk's offer of $54.20 apiece, as I said. The deal hammered shares of Digital World Acquisition Corporation, the SPAC that's trying to merge with Donald Trump's Truth Social platform. Shares there down 12.9%. Read into that what you will. News of the deal also sent shares of Musk's other company lower. No, not the space company or the tunnel company, the electric cars company. Tesla down 0.7%. Today you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lauren Hirsch talked about why the Twitter board took Elon Musk's offer of $54.20 a share when we were talking up at the top of the show. Bottom line, it's a good price, and they were looking out, she said, for shareholders. And that's the mantra in American capitalism, right? Maximizing shareholder value? Well, yes and no. I mean, it is the mantra, but how and why it came to be that way? Marketplace's Scott Tung looked into that for us back in 2016.
It all began with a professor. At the University of Chicago, economist Milton Friedman wrote this in 1970. There is one and only one social responsibility of business, to increase its profits. For whom? For stockholders, he wrote. This was a brand new idea that took, because the old corporate model was crumbling under pressure from inflation and from weak growth. Rick Wortsman of the Drucker Institute is the author of The End of Loyalty, coming out this year.
Some called it slumpflation. Inflump was another one that circulated. But most famously was stagflation.
It exposed American companies as uncompetitive.
Many companies had gotten fat and lazy during the golden age of American business. We just didn't see the seams starting to come apart until the late 60s, early 70s.
Friedman and his Chicago colleagues argued that companies were taking on too many social responsibilities, providing jobs, helping to fight pollution, and end discrimination. It was inefficient.
We saw enormous amounts of waste going on.
Economist Mike Jensen was a student of Friedman's, and he co-wrote the most cited business paper ever. Shareholders suffered, he wrote, because executives were selfish. They wanted perks.
You can't ignore the self-interest of everybody that's involved, and you can't assume that firms maximize profits.
CEOs feathering their nests. Now, some of us of a certain vintage recall the 80s film Wall Street. It stars a rather obnoxious shareholder, Gordon Gekko, here talking to other shareholders.
You are all being royally screwed over by these bureaucrats with their steak lunches, their hunting and fishing trips, their corporate jets and golden parachutes.
Now, if you listen closely, Gordon Gekko was channeling his inner University of Chicago Mike Jensen. If you shape up executives, you shape up companies, and shareholders win.
Quite often, something that's significantly new and right, or basically right, is rejected by the profession because it's too new. But that all went away eventually. It caught on. It stuck.
Jensen went on to become a superstar prof at Harvard Business School, where his ideas went mainstream. David Langstaff was an MBA student then, before going on to run companies in national defense.
The dominant and the accepted understanding at the time, which continues, is that business is there to make a profit for shareholders, period.
So, into the 80s echo chamber, along with big hair and new Coke, went three business words.
Maximize shareholder value.
Mike Jensen may not have used those words, but that's how his ideas got applied by a whole generation of leaders, says Roger Martin. He's former management dean at the University of Toronto.
There was an obsession with shareholder value maximization as manifested in meeting your quarterly earnings so the analysts are all happy with you.
How happy? Stocks soared 12-fold in the 80s and 90s. For every $1 in profits, 80 cents went to shareholders through dividends and what are called buybacks. Which brings us to the rub. A fast way to fast profits is cutting jobs. Rick Wortsman of the Drucker Institute says what began to erode at this time is what he calls the corporate social contract.
That basically said, if you come to work every day and you work hard, and you give the corporation a measure of loyalty, we in turn will take care of you, often for the rest of your life. All that changed.
Wages flattened. Pensions and healthcare benefits eroded.
This idea of maximizing shareholder value is an important reason why all that happened. There are other reasons. The rise of technology, globalization, the decline of unions. But I'd put it right up there with any of those other factors.
To many, the relevant case study here is General Electric in the 1980s, run by an old college hockey captain named Jack Welch. Now, GE in the 50s, like many companies then, made explicit that workers and research came first, shareholders last. But under Welch, it downsized more than 100,000 workers in 5 years, one of his strategies being to dump the lowest 10% of performers. Here's Welch at the MIT Sloan School of Business in 2005.
Okay, you know exactly who the turkeys are. And they're right amongst you. Baseball teams do it every day. It's the way it is. Why should business not have cuts?
Welch cut entire divisions and plants. He famously demanded that his managers fix it, sell it, or close it.
A lot of people initially were a little bit alarmed.
Nicholas Heyman of the investment bank William Blair is a long, long-time GE analyst, going all the way back to the 80s. He spoke by phone.
GE's actions spawned a lot more similar type of aggressive cost restructuring across industrial America in the late 80s and throughout the 90s.
Fair or not, Welch became the face of maximizing shareholder value, its winners and its losers. In his 2 decades at the helm, GE met Wall Street expectations almost every single quarter. A $14 billion company became a more than $400 billion behemoth. Welch himself made nearly $1 billion. So other executives followed, sometimes to be like him and sometimes out of fear. Because in the mid-80s, some testy shareholders with deep pockets started to buy out big companies and fire underperforming executives. There's accountability. Another one bites the dust. This all took on different names, from corporate raiders to today's activist investors, perhaps the most famous being Carl Icahn. Hedge fund manager Jeff Graham has written a book on these battles. It's called Dear Chairman.
If you're the CEO of a company, then you have to keep that stock up. There's a famous quote from Carl Icahn from the 1980s. You need to keep that stock up or someone will do it for you.
Shareholders first. It became gospel. But the question is it even in the scripture? Does the law require it? Cornell law professor Lynn Stout is the author of The Shareholder Value Myth.
There is a widespread and completely erroneous belief out there that there's some sort of legal duty that corporate managers have to, quote, maximize profits or maximize shareholder value.
In Stout's view, the misplaced assumption comes from an old, old case that cites stockholders' interest. But to stay out of the weeds here, she argues it did not set precedent. By contrast,
you can just pick up the Supreme Court case Hobby Lobby decided just a few years ago, read the majority opinion where Justice Alito says, and I quote, modern corporate law does not require for-profit corporations to pursue profit at the expense of everything else.
Now, just to be clear, law professors still argue about this. But the point is, it's far from a legal given that companies have to make profits for shareholders. And yet, it became the law of the land. And to Stout, it led directly to some bad decisions. Enron, the BP oil spill, the financial crisis. Which brings us back to the man widely acclaimed as the intellectual father, Mike Jensen.
Is it happened exactly the way I wanted it to happen? Nah, probably not.
Jensen says the shareholder focus in some cases went overboard.
There's always going to be some people who take it too far and then cause damage.
He says focusing only on stocks and stockholders is a misreading of his scholarship. For the record, he wrote in 1990 that CEOs should, quote, do what is in the shareholders' best interest. Now, he says,
I wouldn't put shareholders at the center. I'm still unhappy about the situation where people end up thinking that shareholders are primary. They're our only bosses. No.
Still, maximizing shareholder value remains in fashion. In one study of the S&P 500 companies, the share of profits going to stockholders has gone from 50% in the early 80s to 86% in 2013, leaving an ever-shrinking pool of money to invest in the businesses themselves. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an opportunity for you if you've got a spare $5 million or so dollars. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. Back in the before times, Warren Buffett auctioned off a steak lunch with him every year, proceeds to a charity in San Francisco. Hasn't happened, obviously, since 2019, and this year's lunch, we are told, will be the last. Buffett is, after all, 91. Anyway, bidding opens June the 12th. The 2019 lunch, just for some comparison, went for 4.6 million American simoleons. Of course, you do get to bring seven friends. All right, super quick moment of economic context, a calendar reminder should you be so inclined. Elon Musk's new company, Twitter, of course, reports earnings on Thursday. Our daily production team is Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.